from across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
Welcome to the Named Lecture Series on the Aero Society Channel, brought to you by the Royal Aeronautical Society in association with Hypermedia. For the usage policy of this and all other content on the Aero Society Channel, please review the terms and conditions at aerosocietychannel.com.
Because the SOC for this lecture was established, this is the 21st, so it was established about 20-odd years ago, and it's designed to look at innovation in aerospace. It was established, in 1990, to honour Sir Thomas Sopwith, one of the great innovators and pioneers in the early days of aviation in England. Such an innovator he was, between 1912 and 1920, his company produced over 16,000 aircraft. What an order book today that would be, of 60 different types. And he was there at that cusp of aviation when we first got airborne, where discontinuity and renewal and refreshment was the order of the day. And throughout the 100 years or so of powered flight, that has been the key theme. Every so often, a discontinuity has come along, which has caused us to step up the jet engine, powered flight in its first instance, getting men out of the cockpit. And that's what tonight's theme is really probably partly about. But these things which suddenly enable us to look at the paradigm in a different way are what aviation is so exciting and so challenging for all of us engaged upon it. I once did have David Cooper Smith's thunder about what he might talk about tonight, simply to say that when I asked if he came by a UAV today, he said, no, but if I did, I couldn't tell you. Which probably says something about where things might be going in the future in terms of range and endurance. David is the Vice President of Advanced Boeing Military Aircraft. He's responsible for leading the advanced military aircraft business elements of the Phantom Works of Boeing Defence, Space and Security, BDS, working essentially on their UAS programs. Prior to his current position, he was the Vice President and Program Manager for the X-45 UAS program, seeing through the designs of the X-45A, C and the N variants, creating a team, creating survival autonomous, long-range unmanned systems for the Defence Research Projects Agency, the US Air Force and the US Navy. Previous to that, he's had a long and distinguished career in aviation, including work in this country on the Harrier 2 program at Kingston, where he said he has many fond memories and many friends from those times with us. David holds a bachelor's degree from some time past. He's a member of the Aeronautical Institutes of Aeronautics and Astronautics of America and the International Council on Systems Engineering. I said I'd spare his blushes by not covering the entire CV, so David, the floor is now yours to talk about UAS systems and the future.
Thank you, David. Thank you for the kind introduction. I really appreciate it. It is really a privilege and a pleasure to be back here at the Royal Aeronautical Society. I was telling David earlier that about 24 years ago, I had the pleasure of carrying the viewgraphs for my boss when he came here to talk, for those of you who remember viewgraphs. I also want to thank you very much for scheduling it this evening. I have a feeling if it was last night with England in the World Cup football, I got to go to a pub and watch it, so it was much better for me, very educational, and I learned a ton. Learned a couple of new phrases, by the way, too. So I'd like to thank the Royal Aeronautical Society for inviting me on its 145th year for the opportunity to participate in this lecture series to discuss one of the most exciting aspects in aviation today. And oddly enough, it doesn't involve pilots. Sorry, David. Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few. It seemed like a good way for me to reflect on this lecture. One of the most famous quotes from one of the most famous speeches by one of the most famous people, delivered in 1940, following the RAF's victory at the Battle of Britain, Churchill could have described the nascent aerospace industry at a time dwarfed by naval and land forces. Prime Minister Churchill's quote was delivered at a time sandwiched between two intense periods of innovation, one surrounding World War II, and the other, as David suggested, at the dawning of the jet age. Today, we're on the cusp of a third, characterized by rapid development of a broad spectrum of unmanned systems. The jet engine changed everything and spawned a period of innovation in aerospace as military aircraft were developed and replaced at a breakneck pace. The first combat jet for the RAF was the Meteor in 1944. By 1949, the first generation of jet fighters was coming to an end with aircraft like the F-86 Sabre. Just 46 years after the Wright brothers made that historic first flight, the Sabre was flying at more than 670 miles per hour. Nearly 10,000 Sabres were built. By the mid-1950s, second-generation jet fighters were being introduced on an almost annual basis. In the United Kingdom, the Swift, Hunter, and Lightning were all introduced between 1954 and 1959. By the time the Lightning and other advanced second-generation fighters like the F-105 Thunder Chief were being introduced, the F-4 Phantom II, the first third-generation fighter, was already flying. We transitioned from first-generation fighters to third-generation fighters in approximately 15 years, and people think the computer industry turnover is fast. As we all know, the F-4 and FGR-2 were eventually replaced by a number of fourth-generation aircraft over the next two-plus decades as the Harrier II, Tomcat, Mirage 2000, Eagle, Falcon, Tornado, and Hornet all entered service. Since the introduction of the FNA-18 Hornet in 1983, a small number of four-and-a-half-generation aircraft were developed, including the Super Hornet, Rafale, Typhoon, which all entered service within the last decade. The only true fifth-generation fighter in service today, the F-22 Raptor, was introduced in 2005, 45 years after the Phantom. First-generation jet fighter to third-generation fighter, 15 years. Third generation to fifth generation in 4.5 decades. So why did it take so long? And why do I think we're about to enter an era of rapid innovation that will rival the early years of jet power? The answer to the first question can be summed up in two words: physics and money. We've taken metal-framed, metal-skinned, jet-powered, crewed aircraft to their limits. Continuing to push further in an attempt to gain incremental improvement in stealth, speed, survivability, and lethality is becoming prohibitively expensive. Not to mention the fact that each of those elements has become increasingly perishable as we all strive to build the next best airplane, radar system, weapon systems, and future generation of mission systems. It would be interesting to know what World War I ace Eddie Rickenbacker would have said about unmanned aircraft. UAVs perform what we call the dull, the dirty, and the dangerous missions. Rickenbacker, known as the ace of aces, had 26 victories and received the U.S. highest honor, the U.S. Medal of Honor. He epitomized the dangerous. As for dull and dirty, 10 years ago, those missions required a pilot in the cockpit. Today, not so much. Pilots are still in the cockpits, but they are also sitting at the controls of ground control stations, flying RPVs as unmanned systems augment manned missions, providing combat commanders options that didn't previously exist. And providing those options is pushing us into the next era of rapid innovation involving unmanned systems. Flying aircraft without a person in the cockpit is not a new concept. And how many of us, as children, owned radio-controlled airplanes? I know I had fun with mine. The military demonstrated the use of simple unmanned aircraft as far back as World War II. But let's face it, there's been a long road between rudimentary, radio-controlled and unmanned airplanes and today's military-grade, remotely piloted and autonomous vehicles. One reason it's taken us so long to get where we are today is primarily due to the capability gap that has nothing to do with the airframe or the control system. Global unmanned systems operations, whether they be at land, under the sea, on the sea, in the air, or in space, require a robust, secure, mobile, global communications network that until recently did not exist. That was one of the key disruptive innovations that was introduced that has allowed this industry now to flourish. As we look back at time, and across industries, it is evident that great periods of innovation are normally driven by a small number of factors, as they were during World War II and at the beginning of the jet age. Necessity, technology readiness, and an unknown need that is suddenly realized and can be met. Today's necessities come from two facts. First, Air Forces around the world are flying aircraft that were originally designed to last a fraction of their current lifespan. Take the B-52 that I've mentioned earlier. It's been flying in service for over 55 years. The newest B-52 operating today was built in 1962. And nearly every fighter variant in operation today has gone through at least one service life extension program. Add to that the global economic situation, and governments are looking for affordable solutions. Unmanned systems that take the people out of the cockpit, reduce the number of airframes required for a specific mission, and increase the number of aircraft a single person can control have an immediate and profound impact on costs, both initial costs and through life costs. As far as technology readiness, I've already touched on one of the previously missing elements, a robust, secure, global mobile communications network. The latest generation of military communications satellites has as much capability as the entire network they are replacing in a single bird. And while the wideband global SATCOM network will help answer the communications needs, there are two other technology requirements that must be met to achieve the potential of unmanned systems. First is the development and adoption of a common mission management architecture and system. The second, given that unmanned aircraft are particularly suited for persistent intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, is the need for an automated system for analyzing the avalanche of data that can come from 24/7, 365 ISR. Sifting through the enormous amount of data from today's systems already has the U.S. Air Force's top intelligence general, Lieutenant General Dave Deptula, saying the service is swimming in sensors and drowning in data. The system must be designed and built to filter information and provide automated decision-making cues in order to allow people to do what we're best at, which is complex pattern recognition, or what may sometimes be incorrectly labeled as using our intuition. The final element is somewhat more nebulous. It's the unknown need that is suddenly met by a new technology or current technologies used in a different way. As unmanned systems started to come into their own in the middle of the last decade, their use was met with a great amount of resistance to their use from many of their customers. I like thinking about the iPod particularly. I remember when my children told me about the iPod for the first time, I didn't really think I needed one. Now I'm fascinated that I have five. Looking back at the initial reaction to some of the unmanned systems in combat, I'm reminded of what Henry Ford of Model T fame said. If I'd asked my customer what they wanted, they'd have said a faster horse. Sometimes what we really need from our customers is inspiration to think about the jobs they perform differently, not necessarily just the next incremental innovation that comes, and we as an industry have become very good at. At the beginning of this millennium, how many of our customers would have pointed to unmanned systems as the answer to persistent or tactical ISR, prompt global strike, intra-theater communications, suppression of enemy air defenses, operationally responsive space, or intra-theater lift? But today, because of the value proposition that unmanned systems offer, they are being looked at to meet all of these needs and more. Pretty interesting airplane. Each of those mission areas represents a warfighting requirement that has gone unmet due to compromises made to develop and field multi-mission, multi-role aircraft. Those are not bad choices. In fact, they were choices of necessity. And I am not advocating an end to piloted aircraft. In fact, it's difficult to truly envision a day without pilots suiting up, climbing in cockpits, and taking to the air. The human brain is still an incredibly efficient computer system that takes very little energy and has great processing capability. It's not difficult to see, however, maybe is the day in the near future where manned and unmanned aircraft are flying in formation to accomplish a mission. That's why I'm convinced we're about to enter a new era of intense innovation. Those of us at Boeing's Phantom Works have been engaged in it now for more than 10 years. And Boeing is betting on it by funding a number of rapid prototyping projects that I'll talk about, and participating in development efforts across the full spectrum of unmanned sea, land, aerial, and
from across the globe, from the center of aerospace, and now to you.
Welcome to the Named Lecture Series on the Aero Society channel, brought to you by the Royal Aeronautical Society in association with IPA Media. For the usage policy of this and all other content on the Aero Society channel, please review the terms and conditions at aerosocietychannel.com.
Because the SOC for this lecture was established, this is the 21st, so it was established about 20-odd years ago, and it's designed to look at innovation in aerospace. It was established in, as I say, in 1990 to honour Sir Thomas Sopwith, one of the great innovators and pioneers in the early days of aviation in England. Such an innovator he was, between 1912 and 1920, his company produced over 16,000 aircraft. What an order book today that would be, of 60 different types. And he was there at that cusp of aviation when we first got airborne, where discontinuity and renewal and refreshment was the order of the day. And throughout the 100 years or so of powered flight, that has been the key theme. Every so often, a discontinuity has come along, which has caused us to step up the jet engine, powered flight in its first instance, getting men out of the cockpit. And that's what tonight's theme is really probably partly about. But these things which suddenly enable us to look at the paradigm in a different way are what aviation is so exciting and so challenging for all of us engaged upon it. I won't steal any of David Cooper Smith's thunder about what he might talk about tonight, simply to say that when I asked if he came by a UAV today, he said, no, but if I did, I couldn't tell you, which probably says something about where things might be going in the future in terms of range and endurance. David is the Vice President of Advanced Boeing Military Aircraft. He's responsible for leading the advanced military aircraft business elements of the Phantom Works of Boeing Defence, Space and Security, BDS, working essentially on their UAS programs. Prior to his current position, he was the Vice President and Program Manager for the X-45 UAS program, seeing through the designs of the X-45A, C and the N variants, creating a team, creating survival autonomous, long-range unmanned systems for the Defence Research Projects Agency, the US Air Force, and the US Navy. Previous to that, he's had a long and distinguished career in aviation, including work in this country on the Harrier 2 program at Kingston, where he said he has many fond memories and many friends from those times with us. David holds a bachelor's degree from some time past. He's a member of the Aeronautical Institutes of Aeronautics and Astronautics of America and the International Council on Systems Engineering. I said I'd spare his blushes by not covering the entire CV, so David, the floor is now yours to talk about UAS systems and the future.
Thank you, David. Thank you for the kind introduction. I really appreciate it. It is really a privilege and a pleasure to be back here at the Royal Aeronautical Society. I was telling David earlier that about 24 years ago, I had the pleasure of carrying the viewgraphs for my boss when he came here to talk, for those of you who remember viewgraphs. I also want to thank you very much for scheduling it this evening. I have a feeling if it was last night with England in the World Cup football, I got to go to a pub and watch it, so it was much better for me, very educational, and I learned a ton. Learned a couple of new phrases, by the way, too. So I'd like to thank the Royal Aeronautical Society for inviting me on its 145th year for the opportunity to participate in this lecture series to discuss one of the most exciting aspects in aviation today. And oddly enough, it doesn't involve pilots. Sorry, David. Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few. It seemed like a good way for me to reflect on this lecture. One of the most famous quotes from one of the most famous speeches by one of the most famous people, delivered in 1940 following the RAF's victory at the Battle of Britain, Churchill could have described the nascent aerospace industry at a time dwarfed by naval and land forces. Prime Minister Churchill's quote was delivered at a time sandwiched between two intense periods of innovation, one surrounding World War II, and the other, as David suggested, at the dawning of the jet age. Today, we're on the cusp of a third, characterized by rapid development of a broad spectrum of unmanned systems. The jet engine changed everything and spawned a period of innovation in aerospace as military aircraft were developed and replaced at a breakneck pace. The first combat jet for the RAF was the Meteor in 1944. By 1949, the first generation of jet fighters was coming to an end with aircraft like the F-86 Sabre. Just 46 years after the Wright brothers made that historic first flight, the Sabre was flying at more than 670 miles per hour. Nearly 10,000 Sabres were built. By the mid-1950s, second-generation jet fighters were being introduced on an almost annual basis. In the United Kingdom, the Swift, Hunter, and Lightning were all introduced between 1954 and 1959. By the time the Lightning and other advanced second-generation fighters like the F-105 Thunder Chief were being introduced, the F-4 Phantom II, the first third-generation fighter, was already flying. We transitioned from first-generation fighters to third-generation fighters in approximately 15 years, and people think the computer industry turnover is fast. As we all know, the F-4 and FGR-2 were eventually replaced by a number of fourth-generation aircraft over the next two-plus decades as the Harrier 2, Tomcat, Mirage 2000, Eagle, Falcon, Tornado, and Hornet all entered service. Since the introduction of the FNA-18 Hornet in 1983, a small number of four-and-a-half-generation aircraft were developed, including the Super Hornet, Rafale, Typhoon, which all entered service within the last decade. The only true fifth-generation fighter in service today, the F-22 Raptor, was introduced in 2005, 45 years after the Phantom. First generation jet fighter to third generation fighter, 15 years. Third generation to fifth generation in 4.5 decades. So why did it take so long? And why do I think we're about to enter an era of rapid innovation that will rival the early years of jet power? The answer to the first question can be summed up in two words: physics and money. We've taken metal-framed, metal-skinned, jet-powered, crewed aircraft to their limits. Continuing to push further in an attempt to gain incremental improvement in stealth, speed, survivability, and lethality is becoming prohibitively expensive. Not to mention the fact that each of those elements has become increasingly perishable as we all strive to build the next best airplane, radar system, weapon systems, and future generation of mission systems. It would be interesting to know what World War I ace Eddie Rickenbacker would have said about unmanned aircraft. UAVs perform what we call the dull, the dirty, and the dangerous missions. Rickenbacker, known as the ace of aces, had 26 victories and received the U.S. highest honor, the U.S. Medal of Honor. He epitomized the dangerous. As for dull and dirty, 10 years ago, those missions required a pilot in the cockpit. Today, not so much. Pilots are still in the cockpits, but they are also sitting at the controls of ground control stations, flying RPVs as unmanned systems augment manned missions, providing combat commanders options that didn't previously exist. And providing those options is pushing us into the next era of rapid innovation involving unmanned systems. Flying aircraft without a person in the cockpit is not a new concept. And how many of us, as children, owned radio-controlled airplanes? I know I had fun with mine. The military demonstrated the use of simple unmanned aircraft as far back as World War II. But let's face it, there's been a long road between rudimentary radio-controlled and unmanned airplanes and today's military-grade, remotely piloted, and autonomous vehicles. One reason it's taken us so long to get where we are today is primarily due to the capability gap that has nothing to do with the airframe or the control system. Global unmanned systems operations, whether they be at land, under the sea, on the sea, in the air, or in space, require a robust, secure, mobile, global communications network that until recently did not exist. That was one of the key disruptive innovations that was introduced that has allowed this industry now to flourish. As we look back at time and across industries, it is evident that great periods of innovation are normally driven by a small number of factors as they were during World War II and at the beginning of the jet age: necessity, technology readiness, and an unknown need that is suddenly realized and can be met. Today's necessities comes from two facts. First, air forces around the world are flying aircraft that were originally designed to last a fraction of their current lifespan. Take the B-52 that I've mentioned earlier. It's been flying in service for over 55 years. The newest B-52 operating today was built in 1962. And nearly every fighter variant in operation today has gone through at least one service life extension program. Add to that the global economic situation, and governments are looking for affordable solutions. Unmanned systems that take the people out of the cockpit reduce the number of airframes required for a specific mission and increase the number of aircraft a single person can control have an immediate and profound impact on costs, both initial costs and through-life costs. As far as technology readiness, I've already touched on one of the previously missing elements, a robust, secure, global, mobile communications network. The latest generation of military communication satellites has as much capability as the entire network they are replacing in a single bird. And while the wideband global SATCOM network will help answer the communications needs, there are two other technology requirements that must be met to achieve the potential of unmanned systems. First is the development and adoption of a common mission management architecture and system. The second, given that unmanned aircraft are particularly suited for persistent intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, is the need for an automated system for analyzing the avalanche of data that can come from 24/7, 365 ISR. Sifting through the enormous amount of data from today's systems already has the U.S. Air Force's top intelligence general, Lieutenant General Dave Deptula, saying the service is swimming in sensors and drowning in data. The system must be designed and built to filter information and provide automated decision-making cues in order to allow people to do what we're best at, which is complex pattern recognition, or what may sometimes be incorrectly labeled as using our intuition. The final element is somewhat more nebulous. It's the unknown need that is suddenly met by a new technology or current technologies used in a different way. As unmanned systems started to come into their own in the middle of the last decade, their use was met with a great amount of resistance to their use from some, actually many, of their customers. I like thinking about the iPod particularly. I remember when my children told me about the iPod for the first time, I didn't really think I needed one. Now I'm fascinated that I have five. Looking back at the initial reaction to some of the unmanned systems in combat, I'm reminded of what Henry Ford of Model T fame said. If I'd asked my customer what they wanted, they'd have said a faster horse. Sometimes what we really need from our customers is inspiration to think about the jobs they perform differently, not necessarily just the next incremental innovation that comes, and we as an industry have become very good at. At the beginning of this millennium, how many of our customers would have pointed to unmanned systems as the answer to persistent or tactical ISR, prompt global strike, intra-theater communications, suppression of enemy air defenses, operationally responsive space, or intra-theater lift? But today, because of the value proposition that unmanned systems offer, they are being looked at to meet all of these needs and more. Pretty interesting airplane. Each of those mission areas represents a warfighting requirement that has gone unmet due to compromises made to develop and field multi-mission, multi-role aircraft. Those are not bad choices. In fact, they were choices of necessity. And I am not advocating an end to piloted aircraft. In fact, it's difficult to truly envision a day without pilots suiting up, climbing in cockpits, and taking to the air. The human brain is still an incredibly efficient computer system that takes very little energy and has great processing capability. It's not difficult to see, however, maybe is the day in the near future where manned and unmanned aircraft are flying in formation to accomplish a mission. That's why I'm convinced we're about to enter a new era of intense innovation. Those of us at Boeing's Phantom Works have been engaged in it now for more than 10 years. And Boeing is betting on it by funding a number of rapid prototyping projects that I'll talk about, and participating in development efforts across the full spectrum of unmanned sea, land, aerial, and space systems, as well as the mission management and other systems required to support the full spectrum of unmanned mission areas. Let's begin by looking at sea-based, unmanned, specifically underwater systems which is an area that doesn't get much publicity, nearly as much attention as those of us on the aero side with UAVs. But recently, the United States Secretary of Navy, Ray Mabus, appeared before Congress and said, unmanned systems are unobtrusive, versatile, persistent, and they reduce the exposure of our sailors and Marines to unnecessary threats. They perform a vast array of tasks, such as intelligence collection, precision target designation, oceanographic reconnaissance, mine detection, and that array will grow exponentially year to year. They're versatile and persistent. They keep our sailors and Marines out of harm's way. They're used for ISR, target detection, and threat detection. Sounds a lot like the same mission elements that unmanned air vehicle systems serve. For the past decade, Boeing has been working closely with the U.S. Navy on long-term mine reconnaissance systems. And while there are many known military requirements for unmanned underwater vehicles, the recent loss of the British Petroleum oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico serves as a stark reminder of the commercial market's need for deep water unmanned systems capable of performing a variety of intricate tasks. The versatility of these systems, the ability to send them into the unknown without endangering human lives, is what makes them uniquely suited for the vast array of underwater missions. Before I figuratively step back on solid land, let's talk a little about maritime surveillance, or as some of us say, maritime domain awareness. For millennia, the vast majority of trade has been tied to our ability to safely transport goods across the sea lanes. The Port of Dover is a prime example. The port has been in operation since Roman times, and each year handles more than 40 billion kilos worth of trade through the harbor. That's a lot of money, and to keep Dover and other parts of the world safe requires vigilance. Who would have thought that in the 21st century, that commerce in the open seas would still be impacted by piracy, much less ragtag groups of AK-47 toting teenagers off the coast of Africa? In the spring of 2009, the cargo ship Maersk Alabama was seized by four Somali pirates. After a scuffle with the crew, the pirates fled to one of the ship's lifeboats, taking its captain, Richard Phillips, with them. When the crew of the United States Navy's USS Bainbridge got within range, the first thing they did to put eyes on the scene was launch a small unmanned aerial vehicle, Scan Eagle. Using the unblinking eye of persistent surveillance, the Navy was able to monitor the pirates, devise a plan, call in additional resources, in this case, a U.S. Navy SEAL team, and effect the rescue of Captain Phillips. The ability to use what must have seemed to the pirates as an unthreatening presence of a model airplane-sized aircraft was essential to maintaining control of the tense situation. Sea-based threats, though well extend beyond the Horn of Africa and the major shipping lanes around the world, and our need for increased situational awareness in order to understand those threats, anticipate them, plan for them, and counter them extends directly into our ports. Maritime domain awareness requires a layered approach that fuses information from a variety of manned and unmanned systems, whether they be underwater, on the surface, airborne, or land-based. Whether engaged in the urban environment or uneven mountainous terrain, the ability to use tactical unmanned systems to find and fix on opposing forces is essential to ground forces. I mentioned the Scan Eagle earlier, and it's a shining example of innovation stemming from the use of existing technology and its application to an unknown and unmet customer need. Originally built to hunt schools of tuna off the great northwest of the United States, the small, Catapult launched UAV surpassed 300,000 combat hours in May of this year. In fact, in 2009, Scan Eagles accounted for approximately 22% of the combat hours flown by U.S. Department of Defense unmanned aircraft. At the end of today's unmanned aircraft spectrum are the remotely piloted Reaper and Global Hawk aircraft. These aircraft are making significant contributions to today's battlefield efforts. As with all initial development programs, they have had limitations, like the fact that they are primarily remotely piloted aircraft, either in theater or from great distances. Global unmanned systems operations require robust global communications, and when those communications are interrupted, remotely piloted vehicles generally go into an automatic holding pattern. This mission stops until contact with is reestablished. That, in fact, happened in October of 2009 when a cat, which has since been dubbed the Al-Qaeda cat, wandered into a power station at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada and shorted out the communications node between military operators at the base and aircraft in theater. In the future, a robust self-healing global communications node that takes advantage of satellite communications, along with near space and high altitude unmanned communication assets, will be essential to uninterrupted mission management. Today, there are a number of high-altitude unmanned systems in development, including the Phantom Eye, which is scheduled to make its first flight early next year. A high-altitude, long-endurance prototype, Phantom Eye is designed to remain aloft for 4 days and is capable of carrying a number of diverse payloads to provide optical or electrical ISR, electrical warfare, or serve as an intra-theater communications node. The leapfrog technology from the 4-day Phantom Eye operations to a full-scale HAL capability of 10-day missions is incremental. Once we achieve 10-day mission capability, 3 aircraft can provide persistent coverage anywhere in the world, even when accounting for the time it would take for the systems to get on station. It would become immediate game changer. How many times have we heard from our commanders in Afghanistan about the need for persistent ISR and the fact that it is one of the keys to effect counterinsurgency operations? Persistent surveillance allows us to effectively track insurgents, identify their centers of operation, and to intercept, disrupt, or prevent their attacks. The flexibility of unmanned systems makes them payload agnostic. If there is increased or unmet need for additional communication bandwidth, a HAL platform could easily serve as a 60,000-foot intra-theater communications relay tower, providing secure satellite coverage for handheld line-of-sight systems. And the byproduct of our HAL vehicle will be water, so it's also incredibly environmentally friendly. Think about what this capability would mean to global humanitarian operations, like the recovery effort after the Boxer Day tsunami in Indonesia. A HAL aircraft launched from Great Britain could have been on station in less than 72 hours, providing a comm link for security rescue operations and essential surveillance to identify where help was needed, as well as what kind of help people needed to provide. As we continue to see in other humanitarian missions our countries undertake, finding people in need and reaching them in those first days after a catastrophe is essential. Unmanned aircraft not only provide the persistence that is necessary for such operations, but the flexibility as well. Going beyond HAL aircraft to near space, ultra-long endurance aircraft will provide a host of new possibilities. Think of measuring missions not in days, but in years. Or as my friends at Kinetic showed me today, at least in weeks before we get to years. Doing so will require the use of solar-powered aircraft, ultra-lightweight materials, and satellite-grade subsystems. To give you an idea of what such an aircraft would look like, Boeing is designing an ultra-long, high-endurance, long, high-altitude, long-endurance capability known as Solar Eagle. With a wingspan of more than 131 meters and driven by 15 motors that are powered by more than 557 square meters of solar cells during the day and hydrogen fuel cells at night. Eventually, HALE aircraft like those envisioned in DARPA's Vulture program will remain aloft for 5 years at a time. 5 years. All of a sudden, persistence takes on a whole new meaning. When you think about the level of disruption provided by a capability like this, you can just start to imagine the possibilities. It's also bringing about a number of new mission paradigms, both within our core defense business and also within the scientific community. Take, for example, the ability to conduct long-term environmental monitoring. Physics and simple orbital mechanics limit our ability to conduct continuous operations over any one location. Today's Earth monitoring satellites utilize polar orbits, which allow them to view the entire Earth at one time, but no single area continuously. And while you can't cheat physics, using unmanned long-endurance vehicles like Solar Eagle could provide near-space Earth monitoring for years at a time. Our understanding of the Earth and mankind's effects on the Earth would be changed forever. That's the kind of paradigm shift that is going to occur thanks to innovative unmanned systems designed and development over the next 5 years. So those of you who achieved awards tonight can look forward to a very interesting next few years in the evolution of the aerospace industry. Somewhere between ultra-long endurance systems like Solar Eagle and tactical ISR systems like Scan Eagle are the medium-altitude aircraft. While payload capacity, range speed, and primary mission for these vehicles vary, the biggest difference may be the level of autonomy designed into each. For those designed as remotely piloted platforms, to the aircraft like the Mantis, which is being designed from the ground up as a fully autonomous ISR and strike aircraft. It is in this class of aircraft where taking men and women out of the cockpit provides the most benefit, as we're taking our crews out of harm's way. In the first part of this decade, and this is really cool, Boeing demonstrated the possibilities of a truly autonomous, combat-capable, unmanned aerial air vehicles. I had the pleasure of leading this team for 3 years. Over the course of 64 flight tests, the X-45A program accomplished a number of significant firsts, including the first weapons release from an autonomous UAV, multi-vehicle coordinated flight, and operation of multiple UAVs by a single operator or mission manager. And I'd like to show you a video, and I note at the start that we had U.S. Air Force maintainers maintaining these aircraft throughout the time we flew them, and notice how comfortable they were with the operations. It was interesting at first watching maintainers comfortable being 1 foot away from a wingtip as the airplane started to autonomously taxi. So this wasn't a vehicle where you had a stick and throttle. This is a fly-by-mouse operation. We informed it of the intent we wanted it to accomplish, and then they accomplished the mission.
Two Boeing JUCAS X-45A unmanned aircraft successfully completed a graduation exercise when they flew their most challenging simulated combat mission at NASA's Dryden Flight Research Center, Edwards Air Force Base, California. The X-45As departed from the base, climbed to altitude, and autonomously used their onboard decision-making software to determine the best route of flight within the area of action, or AOA. The pilot on the ground approved the plan, and the two unmanned vehicles entered the AOA, a 30-by-60-mile area within the test range, ready to perform a simulated preemptive destruction suppression of enemy air defenses mission. The mission involved identifying, attacking, and destroying pre-identified ground-based radars and associated missile launchers before they could be used to launch surface-to-air missiles. During the test flight, the X-45A unmanned aircraft faced a simulated pop-up threat, used evasive maneuvers to avoid it, and autonomously determined which vehicle held the optimum position, weapons, and fuel to attack the higher priority simulated target. Once the pilot authorized the attack, the unmanned aircraft simulated dropping weapons on the target. After engaging and destroying a second simulated target, the two X-45As completed their mission and safely returned to Edwards.
The lessons we learned during those historic flights are being directly applied to the Phantom Ray. I'm sorry, let me just go back for a second. The Phantom Ray, which is in your lower right, which is an outgrowth of the X-45C program. As a company-sponsored prototyping effort, Phantom Ray will fly later this year and serve as a testbed for critical technologies. Capable of a full range of combat missions from ISR, electronic warfare, and ground attack, we expect the Phantom Ray to be as groundbreaking as the X-45A. One of the most dangerous missions we ask our air crews to fly is the suppression of enemy air defenses, or SEED mission. It takes a special person to fly into the teeth of an air defense system, daring your enemy to engage and make themselves visible, counting on your skill and betting your life on the airplane you're flying and its defensive and offensive systems to be better than the air defenses you're attacking. Remember the three Ds, the dull, the dirty, the dangerous? For decades, we've counted on air crews to literally put themselves in harm's way for their fellow warfighters. With unmanned systems, we won't have to put those air crews at risk. Before I wrap up, let's look at a mission that both the MOD and the United States Marine Corps are looking to fulfill with unmanned systems. Throughout time, military leaders have talked about the importance of supply and logistics. From the writings of Sun Tzu to Napoleon, who said, "An army marches on its stomach," or Rommel's, "The battle is fought and decided by the quartermasters before the shooting begins." The great military thinkers of their time knew that the ability to supply one's army was inversely proportional to its distance from home. The issues and importance of logistics have only grown over time. After all, armies can no longer live off the land or pick the fallen arrows of their enemies. And counterinsurgency operations or humanitarian relief require far more than just a steady supply of beans and bullets. What hasn't changed over the millennia is the difficulties and dangers associated with the last mile or 100 miles of the supply chain, that critical link between an established in-theater supply depot and a forward operating base or deployed company. The U.S. Marine Corps is looking to solve those issues with an autonomous rotorcraft like the A-160T, just entering production, and is capable of delivering over 2,500-pound slung loads over a 150-mile round trip. Here's a recent test in January on the A-160T. It completed a number of firsts for the system using its optimum rotor system. One of the real challenges also was the stability of the load with this light a vehicle carrying 2,500 pounds.
Clear.
It's also remarkably stable and quiet unmanned aircraft. With a fuel fraction, that's about 50%, so it has tremendous endurance. Again, fly by mouse. So this is not remotely piloted. Then here's a view from the aircraft dropping the load. And no, it wasn't near those commercial airplanes. We're Boeing, we protect all of our commercial airplanes. Think of the difference that kind of unmanned capability could mean on the battlefield. The ability to deliver supplies directly to those in need without putting others at risk will be a total game changer. Thinking beyond supply, what about using unmanned rotorcraft to rescue climbers stuck at altitudes that are today too high for manned aircraft, or sending an unmanned aircraft into hostile territory to recover a downed air crew or an injured soldier? The MOD is taking a different route with its development of the assisted carriage systems, a robotic all-terrain vehicle. Designed to relieve the workload of soldiers, each vehicle will support an 8-man infantry section, offloading 40 kilograms of individual equipment. While able to operate autonomously, it can be driven as well. Today, all-terrain vehicles are making a significant difference to the British Army in Afghanistan, where quad bikes are being used to deliver food, water, and ammunition to frontline units, as well as to evacuate casualties. Providing a similar but unmanned and autonomous capability to free up an additional soldier puts more boots on the ground to achieve the mission. The unmanned systems in operation today are already changing operational doctrine, but think of the challenges and changes that are yet to come. With a true common mission management system, a single operator can control the unmanned aerial refueling, ISR, electronic warfare, or strike assets required for a deep strike mission. Conversely, a long endurance ISR and electronic warfare asset can be handed off from one operator to the next as its capabilities are needed to support other missions. For example, a Phantom Eye-like aircraft could be used to track insurgents' movements in the morning in support of ground forces, be handed over to another operator for an electronic warfare mission, and then to another operator in the afternoon to support a close air support mission, and then hand it off again in the evening for a signals intelligence mission. And while we've talked a lot about the financial incentives for using unmanned aircraft, there are also environmental impacts. Designing systems around human needs generally leads to larger aircraft with more power requirements. Think of the fuel burn of an A-160 that delivers supplies to the forward base versus one of my favorite aircraft, the Chinook. An aircraft that can stay aloft for 10 days at a time eliminates the need for dozens of aircraft that accomplish the same mission. Most likely, such an aircraft would be operated on an alternate high-energy fuel like hydrogen, whose only byproduct is, as I said earlier, water. The possibilities of unmanned systems used by themselves or in concert with manned systems is unlimited. There are dozens of known unmet requirements that are particularly suited to unmanned systems, whether they be in support of military customers, science, or academia, or for humanitarian missions. And as I said before, what we've learned from the past is that innovation is driven by any combination of the following: necessity, technology readiness, or an unknown need that is suddenly realized and can be met. Ongoing global and humanitarian military and humanitarian missions and the economic realities of our governments and the challenges they are facing are driving the necessities for change. As we look across our industry, there are rapid advances in solar and hydrogen-powered airplanes, lightweight composites, and robust, secure global satellite communications. Finally, the nascent unmanned systems in operation today are already identified unknown and previously unmet needs for ISR and strike capabilities. In closing, we've already proven autonomous unmanned aircraft are capable of taking on those missions and many more. We're standing on the cusp of a new era of intense innovation. Now it's up to us in industry to prove that we can deliver on that promise, to achieve what a few years ago seemed impossible. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you for listening to the Named Lecture Series. Find more from this series and other events at aerosocietychannel.com. Join over 17,000 members across more than 100 countries and enjoy an excellent range of benefits. Become a member of the Royal Aeronautical Society. See www.aerosociety.com to find out which membership is right for you. This presentation was brought to you by the Royal Aeronautical Society in association with IPA Media. For the usage policy of this and all other content on the Aero Society channel, please review the terms and conditions at aerosocietychannel.com.